From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 30 of NIH Research Radio with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, the most recent analysis of a long-term NIH-funded study found that children who received higher quality child care before entering kindergarten had better vocabulary scores in fifth grade than did children who received lower quality care. A National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute study found that as rates of diabetes have risen in the U.S., the proportion of cardiovascular disease linked to diabetes has also increased. There's evidence that the ancient art of Tai Chi may help older adults avoid getting a painful condition known as shingles by boosting the immune response to the varicella vaccine. And we'll hear all about deep brain stimulation for the treatment of Parkinson's disease from a neurosurgeon who may soon be performing the procedure on your humble podcast host. But first, some advice on how to help your children deal with the fears that may have been caused by such traumatic events as the recent shootings at Virginia Tech. That's next on NIH Research Radio. At the NIH, we know there's much to be learned from families, especially where one brother or sister has rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, or myositis, and the other does not. Now, does that sound like your family? Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116. If you're eligible, study-related tests are free. You'll be compensated for your time, and transportation may be reimbursed. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In the aftermath of such shocking and tragic events as the recent shootings at Virginia Tech, it's only natural for people to suffer some residual emotional effects. Dr. Faris Tuma, chief of the National Institute of Mental Health's Traumatic Stress Research Program, said it's important for people to acknowledge that they've been affected by tragic events like this in order to help them deal with the emotional impact.
An event like this clearly has many ripple effects to the local community, to people who have known the young man who was involved, his family, those who knew the other victims, as well as other people who were not directly impacted. We know from experience that all of these kind of groups of people, there are consequences for them, and parents should surely be prepared to address their own feelings about what has happened, in addition to staying very closely tuned into their children's emotions and behaviors.
Dr. Tuma said events like the Virginia Tech massacre can also have a lingering effect on children and cause them to worry about their own safety. He suggested some ways for parents to deal with their children's fears.
In general, and it sort of depends on the age of the child, it's probably a good idea for parents to be prepared to explain what's happened as best that they're able, to encourage their children to express their feelings and to listen to them without sort of passing judgment of telling them that they're right or wrong about the way they feel. Children need to be reassured that it's okay to be upset after something bad happens. And generally, things that parents can do, like maintaining home routines, are pretty reassuring to children, you know, that things are going on as they were before, even though something horrible has happened.
Dr. Tuma said it's important for parents to deal with their own emotions after such a tragic event as well.
We know pretty well now that children take a lot of their cues from how their parents are doing. If a parent is feeling distressed, sort of sitting on that and stewing in it is probably not going to be a good thing in the long run to help their children.
You can find more information about post-traumatic stress online at www.nimh.nih.gov. Historically, Tai Chi has been considered one of the Chinese martial arts. However, the practice of slow-motion routines that groups of people practice every morning in parks across China and other parts of the world has developed a worldwide following for its perceived health benefits. Some have even called Tai Chi moving meditation. Now there's evidence that this ancient art may help older adults avoid getting a painful condition known as shingles by boosting the immune response to the varicella vaccine. Research supported by the National Institute on Aging and the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine suggests that a behavioral intervention like Tai Chi, used alone or in a combination with a vaccine, can help protect older adults from the varicella zoster virus, which causes shingles. Dr. Andrew J. Manjin, chief of the Neurology of Aging Program at the NIA, explains.
Several other smaller studies have looked at exercise to help immunity and well-being. Certainly we know that the brain can modulate immunity, and this may be working through brain systems because Tai Chi is not only an exercise program, but it also involves meditation and stress reduction.
In the study, Tai Chi alone was found to increase participants' immunity to varicella as much as the vaccine typically produces in 30 to 40-year-old adults. Tai Chi combined with the vaccine produced a significantly higher level of immunity, about a 40% increase over that produced by the vaccine alone. The study also showed that the study participants participating in Tai Chi had an increase in immunity that was double that of the group of participants that took part in health education. Dr. Manjin said the impact of this study may go beyond protection from shingles alone.
The interesting thing here is that the implications are that it may be not limited to zoster, but it may be something that would be a behavioral adjuvant, a way of boosting the immune response of older people to a number of other vaccinations, such as for influenza. Since there was nothing specific in the Tai Chi related to shingles.
The study appeared in a recent edition of the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. When we come back, we'll hear all about a procedure known as deep brain stimulation from a neurosurgeon who may just be performing the procedure on yours truly. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it. At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In the past couple podcasts, I've talked about how I'm taking part in a clinical research trial to test the safety and tolerability of a procedure known as deep brain stimulation on people in the early stages of Parkinson's disease. I was diagnosed with PD more than 7 years ago and learned about this study by logging on to www.clinicaltrials.gov. a service of the National Institutes of Health developed by the National Library of Medicine. The study is being conducted at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and twice so far I've been the guest of the General Clinical Research Center, which is funded by the National Center for Research Resources at the NIH. During one recent visit, I had the opportunity to sit down for a chat with Dr. Peter E. Conrad, Director of Functional Neurological Surgery and Associate Professor of Neurological Surgery and Biomedical Engineering at Vanderbilt. In phase one of this clinical trial, 15 people will be selected to undergo deep brain stimulation, while 15 will be assigned to a control group and will continue their current regimen of medication. When I spoke to Dr. Conrad, I was still unaware of which group I'd be joining. Dr. Conrad and I chatted as he visited me in my room at the General Clinical Research Center. Well, let's talk a little bit about deep brain stimulation. To put it simply, pacemaker for the brain.
Correct. Electronically, what's happening is that the unit only works for patients when it's in a high frequency mode. Mm-hmm. So when it's at a low rate of stimulation, let's say under 100 times a second or 100 hertz, the stimulation doesn't actually work well. And in fact, it drives the circuits into an abnormal pattern, not prevents them from being abnormal. So when it's put in the high-frequency mode, this is what Dr. Benabid in Grenoble, France, had pieced together along with a lot of other physicians and scientists back then, that high-frequency stimulation can effectively mimic the old destructive lesions we used to do.
The pallidotomies,
the pallidotomies,
right.
And the thalamotomies.
Right.
And in fact, for those of us who do those things, the way we know where to create that pallidotomy lesion or injury is just before we turn on the heat probe, immediately before that to test it out, we put the unit into a high frequency stimulation mode, and if we see the problem the person has go away, whether it's tremor or rigidity, then we know, aha, the lesion's going to work there. And then we used to flip the unit over to a heat mode and just make a teeny, very precise hole or burn there. So it wasn't too big of a leap of intellect to say, well, gee, instead of burning holes in people's brains, why can't we leave a high-frequency stimulator in there if it's going to do the same thing?
Now, basically what this does, it interferes with the hyperactive electrical signal that that area of the brain is putting out, which causes the symptoms, right?
Correct. The recordings we get from the brains of patients in various states of the diseases all indicates that the neurons in that region of the brain are revved up. They're firing at a rate higher than typical. In fact, we have an abstract coming out to show that as the disease gets worse in humans, just like in animals, the firing rates of this nucleus, STN, gets out of control. And that then leads to all the downstream effects of abnormal stiffness in muscles, tremor, a system that's sort of overcharged, so to speak. The stimulator basically brings that idling back down.
You've done a lot of these.
Yes.
What's the feeling you get when you get that electrode in the right spot? You've hit the money spot. You know you're in there. What does that feel like to you?
As a surgeon?
As a surgeon.
Oh, it's very gratifying because actually the patient will tell us, gosh, this feels just like my medication does. Or I haven't seen my hand that steady in 10 years.
When I've talked to my friends about the possibility of my going through this, it's like, oh God, they keep you awake for this? That's vital to this surgery, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. We still don't have a nice little red dot or some marker on an MRI scan that says put the electrode here and it's going to work 100% of the time. And part of it is because everybody's brain is just a little bit different in shape and size. Just like no two pair of glasses fits the same person, everybody's got just a little bit of different anatomy in their brain. And so in order to customize that implant to work well in a patient, we have to understand the micro anatomy in that area, and there's no other way to do it except right now by having a person awake and testing the device out and creating that micro map for that individual.
Now, it's not like finding a needle in a haystack, the haystack being the brain. You have a general idea where you're going. You just showed me on my MRI the general area that the electrodes would go. So I understand that as a matter of finding, as I called it, the sweet spot in that narrow area.
Yes. Our initial guess, so to speak, when we target for the initial implant, so for a patient coming into the operating room, we know that pretty much if we target to a certain dimensional spec in the brain, that we'll be within about 5 to 7 millimeters of where we ultimately want that to be. But that isn't good enough to leave the implant there with that error. And it's, again, like throwing darts. We don't want to be on the 10 or the 20 ring. We want to hit a bullseye. Close just isn't good enough. Now, even as close as we get, we've got to get it to within a millimeter or two.
Now, this isn't something you just show up and have done. There's a lot of prep work that needs to be done from the patient's point of view and from the doctor's point of view. You mentioned the brain mapping. There's the insertion of the bone markers. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, well, at Vanderbilt, we've taken the surgery and broken it up into three shorter steps. I was never happy with putting somebody through an entire day of surgery. It gets to be quite tiresome.
That's a pretty big day.
It's a long day. And the concept, again, of having a large frame put on your head and being locked to the bed is difficult for a lot of people. So We've adopted a technology using rapid prototyping technology from the industry, and it's actually geared now into a medical device called the Starfix microtargeting platform. You can look at this on the website for the Fred Hare Corporation, and they make this as a commercially available product. It's FDA approved, and it's a tool that I adopted four years ago that lets me get to the area of the brain with the same precision or I think better than the big system. So in a nutshell, basically it comes in for an outpatient scan, CT and an MRI, and placement of these teeny little bone markers.
To me they look like those wall anchors you put into a drywall to hang a picture.
Yes, and then just scale it down to about 3 millimeters.
Right.
And so when the person's asleep for the scan, which is another huge advantage, because by putting sleep for the studies, I feel I'm able to get a motion-free picture. And a lot of Parkinson's or dystonia patients or tremor patients, if they have their pictures done the morning of the surgery, because they have to be awake for the surgery, the scans sometimes can have a lot of shake. So by putting someone to sleep and getting the scan with them asleep, we get a very clean, crisp image. And then while they're asleep, it's just easy to drop these four little anchor points in. And these little anchors are basically attachment points for a yet-to-be-made, customized platform that allows us to mount the instruments needed for the surgery the following week. So then the patient wakes up and goes home with these little anchors installed on their skull, and it's covered with a little staple. It's just a little puncture, a few millimeters big. And then that allows me to take the pictures that we get from that day and relate the target where we want to go with the little anchors. We send that information off to the company, and they then take the information and create a custom fixture from it. And this has evolved from the industry of rapid prototyping, where manufacturers take a drawing, basically, and they can create any three-dimensional object, much like a layered printing process.
And you showed me one of these when we first met in February. You wouldn't know what it was to look at it, but to have it described to you, and there's some very good pictures of it on the booklet that you put together here at Vanderbilt.
The company sends us back this platform within about 3 days, and we have it waiting in the hospital. And then the patient can come in for the surgery, and we don't have to perform scans and mounting of the halo and all that stuff the morning of the surgery. We just walk in the operating room. This little platform's available. It's probably one-tenth the size of the big halo system, and it basically then screws right into those little anchor points for the duration of the surgery. So the patient can turn their head, sit up for the case, look around, tell us more about what's going on, and not feel like they're sort of bolted down and unable to move, which is always, again, a very uncomfortable scenario for somebody who's off their medication that has Parkinson's disease. It's very frightening to be locked to a table for several hours. So, and then at the end of the procedure, once we use this platform to basically put our electrodes in, the little anchors are removed and the platform's given to the patient or discarded or whatever.
Well, I'll want mine.
And it's allowed us to take about 3.5 to 4 hours off the front end of the surgery. So our surgery times are quicker. We usually get both implants done typically before noon. And for us at a major research center like this, and in which we also want to ask some questions, we don't want to waste time with unnecessary, inefficient parts of the procedure. We want to get the procedure done, and we want to be able to make sure that implant's in the right spot. So the whole goal for that middle step is to basically map the area to a fine degree of precision and then implant the electrode and lock it in place into the skull, and then that's all we do that day. We get both sides done. Typically most Parkinson's patients have to have one electrode on either side of the brain, but essentially at the end of that day we leave the electrodes in and the patient goes home the next day. The third step of the procedure, we bring the person back as an outpatient and put them to sleep for the parts they don't have to be awake for,
which
is basically the hookup of the brain electrode with the little generator or the computer. It's actually much more than a battery. People call it the little battery it's hooked up to. It's actually got a sophisticated computer inside of it, a programming apparatus, the things that allow us as the clinicians to tell the device exactly how to run the electrodes and mm-hmm. what frequencies and all of it. It's about maybe a quarter of an inch to a third of an inch thick and maybe 2 to 3 inches long mm-hmm. and maybe an inch and a half wide.
That's nothing huge.
A lot of people can easily hide it underneath the skin, below the collarbone, and not even know it.
And then the step after that heals up, patient comes back again for the fine-tuning, right?
Unlike pacemakers for the heart, which can be pretty well programmed right the moment they're put in, because it's pretty well understood how the tissue will heal around that mm-hmm. heart electrode, the brain electrode lead, the tissue can heal in with different electrical properties, so to speak, that would necessitate a different intensity of stimulation mm-hmm. to get the same effect. And we don't have as much playroom to just double or triple the juice coming out of the unit to control that person's symptoms. If we turn the implant up too high, there's no question we can capture structures we don't want, which pretty much just results in undesirable tingling
right.
or tightness somewhere. And so there's a window of therapy where we want to hit, and so we have to let that implant actually settle for a few weeks before it becomes real stable. Normally, if we wait about 3 weeks before the first program is tried on this, then the programming is pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Be patient for a couple weeks, let the unit heal in, and then once the person comes in for programming, the programming is very predictable mm-hmm. from that point. The electrode doesn't move. So if one of the electrodes is effective in stimulating the target, then that electrode will be the effective one from there on.
Right.
And
now, this clinical trial that I'm screening for now is to study the safety and tolerability of deep brain stimulation in early Parkinson's. And am I right? You've done a few in this trial
yes.
already? Finding any surprises?
Pleasant surprises so far. First three patients we've done, implant-wise, actually have been easier, in my opinion, to find the target than the advanced Parkinson's mm-hmm. patients do. And part of it is because as people get older and the disease progresses, their thought processes also get bogged mm-hmm. down, and they have a harder time speaking exactly what we ask them to. In other words, it's sort of like going to the eye doctor and getting fitted for glasses, and you put that thing in front of your eye and they say better or worse.
Yeah.
And we kind of do the same thing in the operating room. We test a point of stimulation and we really want to know, is this point better or worse than the last one we were
mm-hmm.
at? And we rely on the patient to a fair degree to kind of help us tune that implant to their best point.
I just want to thank you, you know, for everything you're doing for people in the Parkinson's community and throughout the entire realm, the spectrum of people with neurosurgical problems. Dr. Peter Conrad, neurosurgeon here at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, thanks again for everything.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate the opportunity.
As I mentioned, when I recorded this conversation with Dr. Conrad, I hadn't yet been assigned to either the surgery group or the control group in the study. Now, however, we've had the metaphorical flip of the coin. I've been randomized to the surgical group. So, sometime, probably in June or July, Dr. Conrad and I will become much better acquainted as I undergo bilateral deep brain stimulation as part of this clinical trial. Once again, taking part in a clinical research study is a very personal decision, and only you and your healthcare provider can decide if such a step is right for you. However, clinical trials are a vital component in the never-ending search for cures and new treatments for a variety of diseases and conditions. Do you have the key that could unlock the vault of medical discovery? You can take the first step by logging on to www.clinicaltrials.gov. When we come back, Wally Akinso tells us how the proportion of cardiovascular disease cases related to diabetes has increased. That's next on NIH Research Radio. At the NIH, we know there's much to be learned from families, especially where one brother or sister has rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, scleroderma, or myositis, and the other does not. Now, does that sound like your family? Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116. If you're eligible, study-related tests are free. You'll be compensated for your time, and transportation may be reimbursed. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency and part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. More and more folks are being diagnosed with diabetes. Likewise, the rate of cardiovascular disease linked to diabetes is going up. Wally Akinso has this report.
A National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute study shows that as rates of diabetes have risen in the U.S., the proportion of cardiovascular disease linked to diabetes has also increased. The researchers compared risk factors for cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular events, such as heart attacks, among the study's participants from two different time periods. Dr. Caroline Fox, lead author and medical officer of the study, talked about what conclusions can be drawn from the findings.
So I think overall the findings emphasize the need for more efforts to prevent diabetes, as well as efforts to aggressively treat and control cardiovascular disease risk factors among individuals with diabetes. The findings also highlight the importance of understanding potential trajectories of cardiovascular disease due to risk factors, because this knowledge is really helpful for efforts to predict trends of cardiovascular disease.
A total of 9,540 individuals aged 45 to 64 were evaluated, one group between the years of 1952 to 1974, the second group from 1975 to 1998. Dr. Fox said most of the increased risk was observed among men. She added that the prevalence of diabetes among those with cardiovascular disease almost doubled between the earlier and later time periods, and there also was an increase in the prevalence of obesity. For more information about this study, log on to www.nhlbi.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
The most recent analysis of a long-term NIH-funded study found that children who received higher-quality childcare before entering kindergarten had better vocabulary scores in the fifth grade than did children who received lower-quality care. However, the study authors also found the more time children spent in center-based care before kindergarten, the more likely their sixth-grade teachers were to report problem behaviors. Dr. James Griffin, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development Science Officer for the study, explained a possible reason for this finding.
There are some people that speculate that those who are in center-based care, because there's more children, there may be more opportunities for conflict and maybe more opportunities to learn some not-so-good behaviors. The other thing could be it's just a way of being socialized in a group versus a smaller setting, and that some of those behaviors persist.
Researchers emphasized that this so-called bad behavior fell into the range of normal childhood shenanigans, like sassing back and getting into fights, and was not considered to be clinically disordered. What's more, according to Dr. Griffin, the biggest influence on a child's behavior is still to be found at home.
We found through sixth grade that parents are actually the biggest influence on children's lives and the best predictors of how they're going to do later in school and socially, much larger than any effects of childcare.
These are the latest findings in the NICHD study of early childcare and youth development, the largest, longest running, and most comprehensive study of childcare in the United States. Families were recruited through hospital visits to mothers shortly after the birth of a child in 1991 in 10 locations in the U.S.
And that's what makes them interesting. We've been studying these children since birth, and so while we can't draw causal conclusions, at the same time it's interesting to see these effects persist all the way into fifth and sixth grade.
The study appears in the March-April 2007 edition of Child Development. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us on Friday, May 4th, when episode 31 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio, the Health Star Radio Network, and online at www.federalnewsradio.com. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info's right there on the podcast webpage. And if we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address, ws159h at nih.gov. Once again, our email address is ws159h at nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.